Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with the Herald and Review of Monday, February 11th, 2019. We are going to start today's reading with the front page story that is from the Decatur Together section, and it is titled Meet the Fiberholics, Long-Running Knit Night Hobbyists Turn Yarn into a Multitude of Things. It's Dateline Decatur. Linnell Smith, age 62, made a pair of lavender gloves that had the look of store-bought. She knitted black lace for an ornate touch. "It's no different than making a pair of socks," she said. "It's kind of fun to make." Smith is one of the experienced and talented knitters at Tuesday's Knit Night, the Decatur Area Arts Council's weekly knitting group. She has been knitting for more than 55 years. "There's not too much I cannot tackle," she said. Although her work is intricate and creative, Smith does what she can to make sure that newbies are comfortable and ready to learn. "Just have fun with it," she said, "and if you make a mistake, I always call it an enhancement of the pattern." Tonda Atchison has been the go-to person for the Knit Night group for 15 years. The group meets on the Decatur Area Arts Council's second floor at 7 p.m. every Tuesday. Throughout their existence, they have had a steady membership of about 12 knitters. "In the summertime, it's more than that," Atchison said. "But new knitters, be warned, once you get started, you won't want to stop." "I have been in a lot of women's groups," Atchison said, "and this is probably one of the best I have ever belonged to." Some of the knitters use simple techniques in creating scarves, blankets, or washclothes. Other knit more complicated pieces, such as gloves. "There are some beautiful things that people do," Atchison said, "but I'm not one of those people." One of the group's appeals is the expertise available to knitters of all skill level. "We have talented knitters," Atchison said. "They will put down what they are doing to teach you to knit, show you how to knit, help you with a pattern, or to help in any way that they can. The end product is interesting, but the process in getting there is most of the fun," group members agree. The knitters work on their projects, but they use the two-hour meetings to talk about children, husbands, and current events, and celebrate any occasion with food. Knit Night is filled with women, but men are welcome to attend as well. For example, a group of Millikan University men have joined previously. The only alteration to the meeting is the subject matter. "We talk about pets," Rebecca Robinson said. "Beginners are welcome. They will need to bring needles and yarn and the desire to learn," Atchison said. Members of the Decatur Area Arts Council can attend for free. Those wanting to try out Knit Night can do so for $3 a visit. The weekly meetings are designed to help encourage other knitters. "They get the basics," Atchison said, "but we will give you the bug." According to the knitters, the hobby can be expensive or economical. A stocking cap can be made with one skein or ball of yarn for less than $5. Others have created items from original patterns with $60 worth of yarn. "You don't do these things to save money," Betty Wheatley said. "And you don't do them to sell them and make money," Robinson added. "You will never get paid for your time." Robinson had a stroke less than a year ago. She took a break but returned to Knit Night recently. "I come because it is a good peer group," she said. "This group is the most open, the most accepting." Kathy Trusner, age 67, attended her first Knit Night in 2004. She soon learned that there was more to the meetings than making a scarf, and she wrapped herself in the opportunity. "It's more of the camaraderie of the women," she said. "This is mindless knitting." Knitting is only one of the hobbies Priscilla French uses to create interesting pieces. She also looms, crochets, paints, and does Japanese braiding. She also does double knitting or two-layer fabrics with knitting on both sides. "I can't do that here," she said. "With the pattern, I have to count continuously. I can't visit and count at the same time." And although French can create unique projects on her own, she prefers to attend Knit Night. "This is a good place to meet other people with my addiction," she said. "You have to be with other fiberholics." And there's a little box that goes with the stories. It says, if you go, what, the Knit Night Knitting Group, when, 7 p.m. Tuesday, where, at the Madden Arts Center, second floor, Schmaltz Classroom at 125 North Water Street. Cost, free for Decatur Area Arts Council members or $3 a visit for non-members. And on the web, visit them at www.decaturarts.org/classes-programs. The other front page story we're reading is headlined, Hazardous Weather Warning Continues. This morning's commute promises to be slippery, forecasters warn. Dateline Decatur. Wherever you are heading this Monday morning, plan on it taking longer than usual to get there. A wave of freezing rain was expected to affect the morning commute beginning about 5 a.m. in the Decatur area. It will follow on the heels of a predicted overnight frigid cocktail of minor snowfall and freezing rain, and even with ice accumulations not expected to top 0.1 inch, the National Weather Service in Lincoln said that would be enough to make driving treacherous in places. The Monday morning commute is what we are focusing on right now, Weather Service meteorologist James Auchin said. And even though any icing or any glaze will be less than 0.1 inch, that could be enough for untreated surfaces to get slick and create an issue. The Weather Service issued a hazardous weather outlook warning covering the weather pattern, which also alerted to a final wave of wintry precipitation due to hit central Illinois from Monday night into Tuesday. This wave will include rain Monday night and then switches to a mix of rain and snow for Tuesday, with snowfall accumulations pegged at 1 inch or less. Auchin said precipitation drains away after Tuesday, but is back by Thursday with rain and a high of 47 before temperatures begin another plunge towards the weekend. A mix of rain and snow is likely Friday with a high of 41, and then snow again likely Friday night as the mercury takes a steep drop to a low of about 17. Snow is forecast as being likely Friday night, but Auchin, speaking on Sunday night, said he could not say how much might be in the forecast. It's too far out to tell right now, he said. Sunday's brush with snow and freezing rain saw both state police and county police responding to several accidents linked to drivers losing control in the slippery conditions. A semi-truck driver who skidded and rear-ended another vehicle on Interstate 70 in Fayette County on Sunday morning was ticketed for driving too fast for conditions, according to state police. A Decatur accident that occurred during a time of slick roads Sunday evening was still being investigated Sunday night to determine its exact cause, said Sergeant Eric Ethel with Decatur Police. Ethel said a vehicle crashed into a light pole around 5:14 p.m., in the 900 block of West Main Street, and the male driver sustained injuries and was taken to Decatur Memorial Hospital. Lieutenant Jamie Belcher with the Macon County Sheriff's Office said the Sunday day shift had dealt with 4 accidents attributed to weather, 2 on Interstate 72, 1 on U.S. 36 near Harristown, and on U.S. 51 near Macon. Belcher echoed the warnings about Monday's commute and urged drivers to be wary. Give yourself extra time and take it slow, he said. We're going to go to some local and state news now. This one is on agriculture. It's headlined, An Exciting Year for Farmers. Federal shutdown and tariffs leave markets in new territory. It's Dateline Charleston. Record yields, soybean tariffs, a federal shutdown. Key moments in the 2018-19 season continue to make for an exciting year for agriculture, albeit not always positive, and the industry's most recent hurdle is proving more problematic as time passes. Outside of leaving government employees without paychecks and having parks with overflowing trash cans, the partial federal government shutdown, at least temporarily stopped by a three-week agreement announced January 25th, also made for a touchy grain market, which in turn has made decisions on selling and planting grain more challenging for local producers connected to the price of soybeans and corn. Among other duties, the United States Department of Agriculture is relied upon to release supply and demand data for grain, specifically soybeans and corn, for local farmers and local commodities traders. As of late January, many were working off information released over a month ago. While juggernauts in the commodities market have been able to wade through it all with better market analytics, the overall markets, and therefore farmers who sell in those markets, have been flying blind on when to sell and what to plant, said Josh Green of Tate & Lyle Coal Station Grain, who is the manager of the Tate & Lyle Coal Station Grain Elevator. It doesn't take much to move these markets now, Mattoon farmer Paul Daly said. Markets are really jittery because we just don't have any information. There is just not a lot of news. We are not getting anything out of Washington. Daly pointed to one example where one Brazilian analyst said the soybean crop in that country was not as hurt, and that news hit soybean prices relatively quickly. The numbers were wrong, though, and there was a production cut in Brazil, shifting the prices back. Daly said for himself and other local farmers, they plant 50-50 corn and soybeans, leaving the gambling on market out of their crop. Some farmers this year went heavier on the soybeans, he noted. Soybeans looked like the profitable crop, with countries like China pulling in more and more soybeans. But that dropped off when tariffs were instated on U.S. soybeans after similar tariffs were made on Chinese exports. Coupled with the shutdown, those in the agricultural community are still cautiously watching what impacts the tariffs on U.S. soybeans will have for the next growing season, which Green said could strike an imbalance in what is planted for the upcoming season. Green said there is concern from some that too many farmers will pull back from soybeans in reaction to the tariffs, that the equilibrium between corn and soybean supply might see an asymmetry. Even still, Daly is optimistic that demand is there for grain and the prices to come back when a trade deal is made. I think the demand is excellent out there, he said. The next local story we're going to read is headlined, Gold Star Memory for Sailor. Troop 43 celebrates 75 years and honors one of its stars. It's datelined Mount Zion. Boy Scout Troop 43 celebrated its 75th birthday on Sunday and paid lasting tribute to the memory of one of its shining stars. As hundreds of scouts, scout leaders, and well-wishers gathered at Troop 43's spiritual base, Mount Zion United Methodist Church, Troop Chaplain Timothy Lee announced the creation of the Logan Stephen Palmer Leadership Success Program. The program will help deserving scouts move ahead by funding scholarships, hosting training, and providing leadership opportunities in the memory of Logan S. Palmer. The 23-year-old who earned his Eagle Scout rank with Troop 43 was one of 10 sailors killed when the USS John S. McCain guided missile destroyer collided with a merchant tanker off Singapore on August 21, 2017. Palmer will be further honored with a gold star in his memory that will become a permanent part of the Troop 43 flag. Logan's star will be the first, and we also want to add stars for anyone who was in our troop and lost their life in the active armed services, Lee said. Palmer's parents, Sid and Teresa, and other members of his family were in the audience Sunday, and Sid Palmer shared a tearful hug with Lee as he got up to speak and acknowledge the tribute being paid to his fallen son. Fighting back more tears, Sid Palmer said his son had reached out to have an enormous influence in his short life. The proof of that had come in all the cards, letters, and gifts of condolence that had arrived to honor him from all over the world. Echoing the Scout motto, Palmer told the audience, "Just always do your best because you never know who you are going to influence." Boy Scout Troop 43 has certainly wielded its share of influence over the lives of young men over the years. It takes its 43 number from the year it was formed, 1943, when fathers marching off to World War II wanted to create an organization that would help raise their sons right at home. Lee said the founder was Mount Zion man Michael Duggan, and it's estimated that the Scout Troop has touched the lives of more than 500 families over the past 75 years. Asked why he thought the troop had endured so long, the chaplain said a tried and trusted formula of taking scouts on adventures, like trips to Yellowstone and Washington, D.C., and giving them a chance to learn and master new skills never grows old. "Our key, our theme, is to build the tools people need for life," Lee said, and it has worked. And we have a couple of briefs here that have local news. This one says, "Semi rear-ends vehicle, 63-year-old injured, Dateline Vandalia. A driver was injured and another ticketed in a crash Sunday morning on Interstate 70 in rural Fayette County. Sergeant Ryan Finney with the state police said a 63-year-old man from Indianapolis was treated at Fayette County Hospital after his vehicle was rear-ended by a semi-truck driven by a 59-year-old man from High School, Tennessee, in the 8:16 a.m. accident which happened in the westbound lanes. Finney said the truck driver was ticketed for driving too fast for conditions as severe weather and icing on the roadway had slowed other traffic. The next brief is Gigi's Playhouse at the library. The Decatur Public Library will host a free program designed for babies and toddlers with Down syndrome and their families, beginning at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 16th, at the library's Children's Auditorium at 130 North Franklin Street. The education group Gigi's Playhouse will present LMNOP, or Language Music in Our Peeps, recommended for newborns to 36-month-olds. The 45-minute class guides parents and young children through basic sign language and other forms of communication using music and language-based activities. At 11 a.m., the 90-minute Destination Discovery class for all ages supports the development of motor skills, social skills, and language through purposeful play and peer-to-peer interaction at a casual setting. And for more information on this program or on Gigi's Playhouse, you can visit their website. This next brief is titled Computer Classes for Low Income. Decatur-Macon County Opportunities Corporation is holding basic computer classes for low-income adults beginning Monday, February 25th, 2019. The classes will teach keyboarding, computer basics, the internet, Windows 10, Microsoft Word, and Excel. Certificates of achievement will be issued to those completing the training. Classes will be held from 9 a.m. to noon on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays for 4 weeks through Wednesday, March 20th at the DMCOC offices at 1122 East Marietta Street in Decatur. There is no charge for the training, but participants must meet income eligibility guidelines based on family size. For criteria and to apply, call 217-428-0155. Enrollment will be on a first-come, first-served basis, and funding is provided by the Community Services Block Grant. And the last brief is titled, "Freeze Exemption Forms Are Available." Macon County's 2018 Senior Citizen Assessment Freeze Exemption Forms are now available at most area banks, credit unions, libraries, or post offices on the county's website at co.macon.il.us or at the Macon County Supervisor of Assessments Office at 141 South Main Street, Suite 401. Those needing assistance may bring 2018 income information to the assessor's office to verify eligibility and to get help completing the paperwork. For more information, call 217-424-1364. I'm going to read a health and safety story now, which is titled "A Bullet in Your Pocket: Lawyers Target Battery Makers in Exploding E-Cigarette Cases." This is not strictly a local story, but it does apply to people across the country. It's Dateline Fort Worth, Texas. What some people thought was a healthier alternative to smoking cigarettes has left numerous people across the nation disfigured and burned after their electronic cigarettes exploded. Now, their attorneys have filed lawsuits targeting the manufacturers of e-cigarette batteries and the vape stores that sell them. The issue of e-cigarette safety resurfaced after 24-year-old William Brown of Fort Worth, Texas, was killed last month when his e-cigarette exploded in his face, causing an artery in his neck to be severed. It is not known what type of device he was using, if it was modified, or what company manufactured the battery. Austin-based attorneys A. Craig Island has four open lawsuits involving injured smokers of e-cigarettes and said all four of his clients face long, hard roads to recovery. Island works alongside his co-counsel, Angela Namens, of Levin Sims Abrams LLP in California. "We have retained 50 cases and have filed 20 so far," Namens said of her firm, "and five of those, including Island's cases, are in Texas. We have clients who have lost teeth or they have had projectile pieces of the device go into their neck and skin," she said. "We have one gentleman who is paralyzed in part of his body because of nerve damage." The injuries in the lawsuits Island has filed are significant. On July 7, 2016, an e-cigarette device inside the left pants pocket of 25-year-old Michael Turner of Houston exploded. He was treated in a burn unit for second and third degree burns spanning from his left thigh to his calf. The battery was an eFest IMR-18650. On March 19, 2017, a man in Pearland, Texas, was injured when his device exploded in his pocket, causing him to catch fire. The e-cigarette was manufactured by WISMEC USA. A Brownsville, Texas woman was injured on May 24, 2017, when her device exploded in her purse. It caused her purse, pants, undergarments, and shirt to catch fire. She suffered second and third degree burns, and that suit targets Samsung SDI company, which manufactured the battery. Also in May 2017, an e-cigarette being held in the pants pocket of Jeff Howes, age 31, exploded, causing severe burns to his genitalia and left leg. He was hospitalized for 11 days. The battery was manufactured by LG, then incorporated into a SMLK GX350 modification. Some e-cigarette modifications allow users to purchase batteries that are bigger and last longer, or tanks that hold more liquid. Electronic cigarettes aren't yet regulated by the FDA, and going after the battery manufacturers poses its own difficulties because they are made abroad, Neiman said. She said Samsung and LG are two major brands. The batteries aren't meant to be used with electronic cigarettes. They're very high-powered batteries that are meant to be used in power tools and things like that. We have an expert we use who has likened these to bullets. You have a bullet in your pocket that can explode at any time. Gregory Conley with the American Vaping Association said injuries from electronic cigarettes are rare when you consider that millions of adults use vapor products regularly. They are generally linked to mechanical mods, a type of product that represents a continually shrinking minority of the market, he said. These devices contain no internal circuitry to stop fire incidences and thus can be dangerous if used improperly. When any lithium-ion battery-operated device is subjected to extreme conditions or used with unwrapped or damaged, used with unwrapped or damaged batteries, short circuits can occur, he said. Users of modern devices like Juul or virtually any product that is not a mechanical mod have nothing to fear from this story, as internal safety mechanisms designed to dramatically reduce the chances of battery issues occurring have become a standard in the industry. Conley said his group supported the Cole-Bishop Amendment, which would have required the FDA to set standards for batteries used in vaping products, but it did not pass. As more cases wind through the courts and become publicized, the possibility of more lawsuits seems likely. Researchers have found more than 2,000 reports of e-cigarette explosions that caused injuries over a period of 2 years. A recent study, done in part by Dennis Toms, Dean of the School of Public Health at UNT Health Science Center, showed that e-cigarette injuries are widely underreported across the nation. Researchers found that there were an estimated 2,035 e-cigarette explosions and burn injuries in hospital emergency rooms from 2015 to 2017, and that number was more than 40 times higher than the number of injuries reported by the FDA from 2009 to 2015. The study also found a lack of a surveillance system to track those injuries. And this story is accompanied by a photo of Alice Brown, who is in her Fort Worth, Texas living room, talking about the death of her grandson, William Brown. The 24-year-old was killed last month after a vape pen exploded in his face. He is at least the second person in the United States reportedly killed by an exploding e-cigarette. And this is Beatrice Pavia with the first half of the Decatur Herald in Review of February 11th, 2019. I will be back with you soon.